This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Paul Ingalls.
Poverty is the absence of all human rights. The frustrations, hostility, and anger generated by abject poverty cannot sustain peace in any society. For building stable peace, we must find ways to provide opportunities for people to live decent lives.
That's Muhammad Yunus, who, along with the Grameen Bank he founded in Bangladesh, was awarded the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize. Yunus and his colleagues were honored for their microcredit systems, which have lifted millions out of poverty in Bangladesh and elsewhere by offering credit without collateral to poor people who were previously ignored by banks. Today on Peace Talks Radio, we'll explore how efforts to reduce poverty around the globe are helping to promote peace with Coralie Bryant and Heidi Topp Brooks, who we'll introduce in a moment in more detail. But first, more from Muhammad Yunus, heard here in his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in December of 2006, talking about the genesis of his program in Bangladesh.
I became involved in poverty issue not as a policymaker or as a researcher. I became involved because poverty was all around me, and I could not turn away from it. In 1974, I found it difficult to teach elegant theories of economics in the university classroom, in the backdrop of a terrible famine that was raging in Bangladesh. Suddenly, I felt the emptiness of all those theories in the face of the crushing hunger and poverty. I wanted to do something immediate to help people around me, even if it was just one human being, to get through another day with a little more ease. That brought me face to face with poor people's struggle to find tiniest amounts of money to support their efforts to eke out a living. I was shocked to discover a woman in the village borrowing less than a dollar from the moneylender on the condition that he would have the exclusive right to buy all she produces at the price that he decides. This, to me, was a way of recruiting slave labor. I decided to make a list of the victims of the money lending in the village next door to the campus. When my list was complete, I had names of 42 victims who borrowed a total amount of $27. I was shocked. I offered this $27 from my own pocket to get these victims out of the clutches of the moneylenders. The excitement that was created among the people by this action got me further involved in it. If I could make so many people so happy with such a tiny amount of money, why shouldn't I do more of it? That's what I have been trying to do ever since. The first thing I did was try to persuade the bank located in the campus to lend money to the poor, but that didn't work. They didn't agree. The bank said that the poor are not creditworthy. After all my efforts for several months, when it failed, I offered to become a guarantor for the loans to the poor. When I gave the loans, I was stunned by the result I got. The poor paid back their loans on time, every time. But still, I kept confronting difficulties in expanding the program to the existing banks. That was when I decided to create a separate bank for the poor. I finally succeeded in doing that in 1983. I named it Grameen Bank, or Village Bank.
To talk about the microcredit system, popularized by Muhammad Yunus, and other poverty reduction efforts that can lead to peace, today on Peace Talks Radio, we welcome Dr. Coralie Bryant, recently with Columbia University in New York, and co-author of the book Reducing Poverty, Building Peace. Also, we'll speak with Heidi Topp Brooks, who is the Albuquerque, New Mexico head of Results, a nonprofit organization working on ending global hunger and poverty. Hosting our interview is Carol Boss.
Well, welcome, Heidi and Coralie. And to begin, if we can talk a little bit about the nature of poverty and how poverty and violence interact with one another. And specifically, is poverty a threat to peace? Would you like to begin, Coralie?
Well, there's been a fair amount of research about it, actually. And if you just think about it, in terms of human stories, the problems of some of the worst kinds of poverty, especially when it's coupled with inequality or social exclusion, breeds a kind of anger and distrust and enemy, if you will. And it is not the case, and this is one of the great complexities about it, it's not the case that poor people themselves march to the barricades immediately. I mean, that might happen, but usually that's not what happens. Usually what happens is other people who see what's happened to them act on their behalf, or, and they may do that favorably, that is to say, they may say, look, this degree of famine and misery is outrageous, and they organize themselves. And much of the history of the French Revolution, which is something I know a fair amount about, the people who actually brought about the start of the revolution were pretty middle class or upper class even, but they did it because of outrage, because of the famine and the bread shortages and the misery that they could see and that they found morally offensive. And they had other political reasons too. But there's a whole lot to say about that. But the role of agitators and catalysts, catalytic events, help to trigger these kinds of problems. I think we're learning a lot more about it. And that's good, because we learn more about it. We might do as we do in the case of any other kind of illnesses, if you will. What you can do upstream to prevent it is really the important point.
So, Heidi, let me ask you your perspective on that. Does poverty itself create a breeding ground for conditions that lead to conflict or to war?
You know, Coralie is really more of an expert on that particular question, but let me just turn it around a little bit and say that if you look at violence, if you look at poverty as a form of violence, and you consider that half of the world's population lives on $2 a day or less, then half of the human family is being subjected to this kind of violence. It's not violence in the form that we think of in, as in war, but it is violence that affects their lives every minute of every day.
I think that's so true. If I can just jump in there. I would like to make one other point right at the front. When I was working on this, the book that I've done on reducing poverty, building peace, one of the major things that I think we need to think about is poverty as a problem that occurs everywhere. And it isn't simply the case that it is largely in Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia, Central Asia. It certainly is there. But we have extraordinary pockets of poverty in northern rich countries too. And there are some differences between the nature of poverty here, whether it's on Native American reservations or if it's in slum areas or if it's in part of the Rust Belt or if it's in pockets of rural America where it gets less seen and less attention. We have some very serious poverty too. And I think one of the things that I've found important is to think about poverty here as well as poverty there, as seeing poverty as a more universal or indeed global problem, and hence a major, major moral mandate, at least that's how I feel about it, that we do something about this, not just because we want to protect homeland security, but because we believe in human security.
Well, I certainly want us to talk about the ways to reduce poverty. Now, microcredit has received a lot of attention this past year with Grameen Bank and its founder, Muhammad Yunus, sharing the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for finding ways for large population groups to break out of poverty. So let's listen right now to part of Muhammad Yunus's Peace Prize acceptance speech, and then we can talk a little bit more about microcredit.
Peace is threatened by unjust economic, social, and political order, absence of democracy, environmental degradation, and absence of human rights. Poverty is the absence of all human rights. The frustrations, hostility, and anger generated by abject poverty cannot sustain peace in any society. For building stable peace, we must find ways to provide opportunities for people to live decent lives. The creation of opportunities for the majority of the people, the poor, is at the heart of the work that we have dedicated ourselves during the past 30 years. Today, Grameen Bank gives loans to nearly 7 million poor people. 97% of them are women. In 73,000 villages of Bangladesh, Grameen Bank gives collateral-free income-generating loans, housing loans, student loans, and microenterprise loans to the poor families and offer them a host of attractive savings, pension funds, and insurance products for its members.
Okay, that is Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. So, Heidi, I know you're very familiar with Yunus. He's on the board of your organization, Results.
That's right. There's something I'd really love to say about Muhammad Yunus and Grameen Bank and what he discovered after running the Grameen Bank for about 10 years. Someone asked him, what's the first thing that people do when they start earning money after they take out a loan? And he said, the first thing people do is they buy their children back. And this shocks me when I hear it, except that it's in the news again. Children are still being sold into slavery by families who are too poor to feed them. And when you loan money to women, as Grameen Bank does, what they do is feed their children. And they send their children to school and they clothe their children. So this is a tremendous way of bringing a certain kind of peace into the lives of the poorest of the poor. And it is desperately needed even today.
Coralie, did you have a comment?
I think that the problem that he's pointing to is one that happens in a lot of places. In a way, he fundamentally, Yunus did a fabulous job, and the Grameen Bank is a fabulous job. It illustrates part of the point I made, because one of the exciting and interesting things happening is the Grameen Bank is now working in this country. And that's part of this way of thinking about, can we learn from what was effective in other places and apply it here to our own problems? We have had quite serious problems with banks that refuse to lend to poor people in our own neighborhood, saying the same thing, they're not creditworthy. What Yunus discovered was the ways in which they can be organized into small groups, and face-to-face groups can help protect and be a surety for one another in terms of paying back the loans. And the repayment rates that Grameen has had is fabulous.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. You can visit us online at peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear this and other programs. Joining us today to explore poverty reduction and peace building are Heidi Top Brooks, a global group leader with Results, the grassroots organization advocating for legislation that will bring millions of people out of poverty, and Coralie Bryant, co-author of the book Reducing Poverty, Building Peace. I want to go back, though, to Bangladesh, and you said that you were there, Coralie, and
yeah.
Ask you and Heidi, if you have any examples, any stories that can illustrate the power of microcredit. Heidi?
Yes, I have a terrific story out of Bangladesh. This is a story about one of the early borrowers from Bangladesh. And she was being interviewed by the executive director of my organization, which is Results, Lynn Walker McMillan. And the woman who was being interviewed through an interpreter gently tapped on the arm of the interpreter and said, tell her that my son is starting university this year. And Lynn said, oh, isn't that nice? My son is starting in the university this year, too. And she tried to turn the conversation again to something else. And the borrower again interrupted and said, please tell her that my son is starting in the university. And after a while, Lynn finally got it and said, oh, I understand. And she said, do you read or write? And the woman said, no. Does anybody in your family know how to read or write? No. Had anybody ever gone to school before? No. So this is a woman who had taken out her first loan as a widowed, pregnant mother and bought a pair of geese. She bought geese. She had no home. She was living in ditches on the side of the road. And from that, she was able to feed her children. This young man who was starting university is the child with whom she was pregnant at the time of her first loan. And by all rights, the child probably shouldn't even have survived. And yet now, in one generation, this young man is going to the university. So completely revolutionizing life for this family.
Anything that you experienced or witnessed when you were in Bangladesh, Coralie?
Oh, lots. I mean, Bangladesh is a fascinating place. It was the case that I was there teaching a course on development management, and there were a few fairly highly placed bureaucrats in the civil administration there who were in the course, and I was keen to have them come to see what microcredit was doing. Some of them sort of knew, but they really had it filtered, other people with different stories, and they hadn't ever talked to anybody who'd actually taken advantage of microcredit. So I organized a trip to a couple of the villages, and in those villages, there were women who had been part of, in this case, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, which was doing microcredit as well, and who had gotten chickens in their case. It was an extraordinary thing because it was exactly what Eunice was saying. Before that, they borrowed from moneylenders, and then they were practically in involuntary servitude for just decades. Hideous, hideous rates of interest that just crippled them. When Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee worked in there, it was like Grameen Bank, same idea. They lent them money, and with that money, they could buy a chicken or they could buy some other beginning way of having an asset. Buying the chicken meant keeping it off the ground, keeping it safe, taking care of it, getting the eggs, and eventually selling the eggs. So we literally went from hut to hut with these, frankly, fairly stuffy and full of themselves, upper-level civil servants who were just didn't believe the stories that I had told them about what was happening with microcredit. They talked to this woman in the front of her hut, and she explained to them that she had gotten these chickens and that indeed she was selling the eggs, and that furthermore she sometimes had enough eggs so her children could eat eggs, which was protein, which was the only source of protein she had, and that with that money she was in fact able to pay school fees so the children could go to school. And because she was in a woman's group, and the women looked out after one another, it also protected her from the fact that sometimes husbands would take money that the wives had earned. But other women in the village would kind of help police that to keep that from happening. And it had been transformative for her. She felt it wasn't just, obviously the important thing was that she could feed her children, that she could earn some money, that she could improve her life. But she also felt a kind of dignity of being in charge of herself instead of being beholden to the money lender. After a long day of talking to a lot of different people in that village and several others, this quite frankly previously pompous civil servant said, well, I just don't believe it. I didn't believe it before, but I certainly know. I've talked to him. It's really a miracle. And, you know, it was breathtaking to me that it took that to have him come to terms with something that was in his own country.
Well, Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus says specifically that lending to women has helped make the microcredit program a success. So let's listen to him discuss that in an interview with journalist Marika Grisel, which is posted on the Nobel Prize website.
When we saw we are giving microcredit both to men and women, because I wanted to make sure 50%, half of the borrowers in my work are women. And this is a kind of a protest against the conventional banks where they reject women. In many, many countries, you'll see the women number of or percentage of women borrowers is far down compared to the percentage of men borrowers. In Bangladesh, the women percentage in the banks among the borrowers, not even 1% of the borrowers that they are providing. So we thought we should address that issue, and we, in our program, 50% of the borrowers should be women. So that's what we did. And then we saw, after we achieved that, money going to the family through women brought so much more benefit to the family compared to the money going to the family through men. Women took good care of their children as their income increased. So we focused on women. As a result, out of the 7 million borrowers that we have, 97% of them are women. And it works beautifully. All the objective is still help the family to get out of poverty. So if you bring in women into the picture, if you empower women, it happens faster than it happens the other way.
Can either one of you talk a little bit about helping us understand how this kind of development promotes peace?
I'd like to take a stab at it, and I'm sure, Coralie, you have a lot to say about it too. But I've been working in this area for a long time. I'm a volunteer with a group named Results, and I'm a citizen lobbyist with that group, and we lobby on hunger and poverty issues. So I'm pretty familiar with the statistics. And of these very, very poor people in the world, 70% are actually women. They do most of the labor, and they do most of the taking care of children. And so when you loan to women and give them the tools that enable them to take better care of their children, you have a much healthier population. And when you loan to women and give them a sense of power and of control over their lives, suddenly their influence becomes more prominent in the society. And this was shown in Bangladesh, where about 7,500 women ran for local office in Bangladesh, women borrowers from Grameen Bank, and about 3,000 of them actually won. So they are becoming more and more a part of what their government and what their society is about.
I think the one thing I might add to that, two things actually, but the one is that for a lot of reasons I don't fully understand, but I kind of know it intuitively because of other peace work that I've done, women in general tend to be much more active in any kind of peace-building movement than men. And in part because as mothers and grandmothers, we care enormously about that next generation. What's happened, of course, is that a lot more have become mobilized because they've had worries of child soldiers, and because in the case of northern Uganda, another place I know quite a lot about, children have gotten abducted. I'm sure you've heard about the Lord's Resistance Army and the abduction of children and turning them into child soldiers and, in fact, trading in children, which is one of the things that many of the people there have suffered from. So that there are gender-specific roles. But I want to come back to say, too, that we've actually learned a lot about ways to reduce poverty, and Results has been very helpful in mobilizing that kind of work. We have an awful lot of pockets of people and lots of non-governmental organizations in this country that that are aware that we've learned a lot more. And that's an important point because not only do you have people saying, well, you know, it's the poor will always be with us and there's really not much we can do and we don't know how to do it. That is fundamentally not true. In the same way that it was not true that poor people wouldn't pay back loans. I mean, microcredit has demonstrated that poor people do pay back loans. They do need to accumulate assets. They have to have assets in order to have some dignity and protect their children. So, but there's a variety of programs, too, that have been very successful in other places and from which we could do more learning. And I'm thinking, for example, of the, here's an example that's caught up in a war-torn country. In Sri Lanka, Tamil and Sinhalese have been at war with one another off and on with a lot of guerrilla terrorist activities. I have a friend who's worked for over 30 years in Sri Lanka, and he works on irrigation programs in which, believe it or not, Irrigation is critical to the survival of many of the crops. And the believe it or not part is he works with Tamil and Sinhalese in small groups. And one of the things that he says that the, you know, social scientists will tell you that you just can't get them to cooperate. And he said it's really not true. That when it's about water, which is fundamental to their livelihood, they work very collaboratively. And the national irrigation programs that they put together with face-to-face groups between warring parties of Tamil and Sinhalese, they have worked collaboratively, they help, and they take care. The trick to the deck is knowing that it makes a difference in the livelihood of their families and that they can support their families and they can take care of their children. And that's a fundamental theme that runs all the way through the microcredit movement. It runs through the self-help housing movement. It runs through what we've learned about participatory development. And furthermore, it works cross-nationally, too. It's not idiosyncratic to third world countries.
We'll have more from our conversation about how poverty reduction can promote peace with author Coralie Bryant and activist Heidi Topp Brooks right after this break. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Visit us online at peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. We've produced dozens of programs in our series, all of which you can hear online at our website, peacetalksradio.com. peacetalksradio.com. That's where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, order CDs, and importantly, do your part to keep this forum for Talk of Peace available on the air and online. Your tax-deductible contribution in any amount helps. All the details are at peacetalksradio.com. Today's topic, the relationship between poverty reduction and promoting peace. This topic drew the spotlight when the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Muhammad Yunus and Grameen Bank for their efforts to offer loans to the deeply poor people in developing countries to help lift them out of poverty and reduce the potential for conflict in their countries. Our guests on Peace Talks Radio today are Dr. Coralie Bryant, recently with Columbia University in New York, and co-author of the book Reducing Poverty, Building Peace. Also, we're speaking with Heidi Topp Brooks, who is the Albuquerque, New Mexico head of Results, a nonprofit organization working on ending global hunger and poverty. Hosting our interview is Carol Boss.
So, Coralie, you made reference to other development programs around the world. Perhaps you can think of one in particular and illustrate for us how effective it has been.
Well, I think one of the first ones I saw early on that I found just totally amazing was a self-help housing project in Lusaka, Zambia. And I first read about it through a flyer from the American Friends Service Committee. I'm a Quaker, and I read, therefore, things from the Friends Committee on National Legislation and the AFSC a lot. And here was a story of a community being organized in order to build their own homes. And it sounded a little unreal to me, and as if it would be extraordinarily difficult, and I couldn't quite believe it. So in the picture, it named the community organizer and where he was and so forth. So I simply wrote him a letter and said, I want to come and see how this works. And he wrote back and he said, you're coming from outer space is sort of where he was thinking, because after all, this letter came out of the blue. But he encouraged me to come, and I went. He was a Zambian, and he was a Zambian community organizer, and he worked on this project, organizing groups of people into helping to plan where to build their housing and helping them with the process of doing it. And the process was really pretty rudimentary and pretty simple, and that is that they've gotten some help both from NGOs but also from a World Bank project to that would give them kind of credit slips if they'd build their own home and occupy their own home. They could rent out a room in it if they wanted to. But in fact, they could even contract with cousins and uncles to help them in putting on the roof, because you can't do that alone. And then there was a supply depot where they could go to get the equipment to do this. And it was a squatter settlement, and it covered a huge area. And the whole point was, as squatters, they were at risk, because it was really easy for others to come in and bulldoze them down or burn them out. But if they could build their own homes and they could improve their own homes, that they'd stay put. And they might become solid citizens, if you want to think of it that way. Well, I literally walked that squatter settlement from end to end, talked to everybody I could talk to, and watched them as they built very simple houses. These were not fancy. These were pretty crude. But the point was, they had security of housing. And housing, like microcredit, is absolutely, it's an asset. You know, you have shelter. We think of homes as, you know, you leave your home to go to work. For very poor people, a lot of them do their work in their home. You know, they gather tires at the side of the road when there have been flat tires, and they make them into sandals, and they peddle the sandals. Or they're women who crochet different kinds of crafts, and they sell those at the side of the road. But they need a place where they can do that. They need the shelter. And hence the issue of home and building your own home. Well, so I was back in Zambia about, oh, I think it must have been a good 20 years later, on a different kind of piece of work, but poverty work. And I thought, you know, I just want to go back and see that place and see what's happened to it. Because some people argued it would just turn into a slum, and others said, hey, that can't possibly work. And I just wanted to see it. So I went around and found somebody who could take me out, because it was, from where I was staying, it was at some distance. And we were headed out there, and he said, I don't know why you want to see this place, you know. He said, this is just another regular middle-class neighborhood. And that was it. You know, they did it. They turned a slum into a middle-class neighborhood. And they did it because they had an asset. They had security of tenure. Nobody could mow them down or burn them out. They could improve their house incrementally, little improvements over time. And I'm not saying that it would look fancy like middle-class neighborhoods in Portland, Oregon, or Portsmouth, Ohio, but it was middle-class for them, and it meant they could have the security of a place where they could sleep and where they could rest and where they could raise their family. And indeed, they could rent it out and earn some income. So it was an amazing successful project. But then I've seen lots of successful projects. And we get a bad press. The successful ones don't often make the screen. I think microcredit has, because of the sheer scale of it, because they're now, the microcredit summit draws thousands of people, and it's huge. The self-help housing movement's smaller, and it hasn't gotten to that same scale. But frankly, it hasn't had that kind of support either.
Go ahead, Heidi.
I do have one thing I'd like to point out, and that is to take off of something you said, Coralie, and that is exactly how large this microcredit movement has gotten. The scale is really, really big.
Mm-hmm.
And it started back in, well, you know, Muhammad Yunus with the Grameen Bank was one of the grandfathers of this movement, but there mm-hmm. were other similar lending programs kind of catching fire individually around the globe, mm-hmm. but he was one of the main ones. But anyway, one of my favorite stories is that John Hatch, who is the founder of Finca Lending, International Lending Group, does mm-hmm. a lot of work in different countries. He was laid up with malaria, and because he's kind of a type A personality, while he was ill, he was trying to do something with himself, and he had this brainstorm that if we set a goal, we could reach 200 million of the world's poorest people with access to microcredit by the year 2005. And he, at one of the results conferences in the mid-90s, proposed that to the Results International Conference there in Washington, D.C., and it got a huge response. People really wanted to go for it, but everybody said, oh, 200 million is too many. Let's make it 100 million. And so they did. They set the goal at 100 million families by the year 2005. And you have to remember that if it's 100 million families, there are people in those families. So with an average of 5 people a family, that's 500 million people. So now we're really talking numbers here. And an interesting side story to that is that when they were trying to figure out how many should be the goal, Muhammad Yunus was discussing this with some of his colleagues, and some of them were saying, oh no, 100 million is too many. And Muhammad said, you think 50 is the right number, 50 million families? And they said, yeah, I think 50 million. He said, okay, you take 50 and I'll take 50. But anyway, so 2005 has come and gone. And so was the goal met? And the question is answered in a kind of a funny way. Yes, it was met, but not exactly the way we had hoped. The goal was to reach 100 million of the world's poorest families, that is to say, under a dollar a day or in the lower half of the extreme poverty. And of those people, in excess of 82 million were reached. Overall, more than 100 million were reached. But as it turns out, we believe that by the end of 2006, and the data aren't all in yet, they will be in November, we will have more than reached that goal. And now there are new goals that have been set. So by 2015, we hope to reach 175 million families with access to microcredit and elevate 500 million people above the $1 a day level of income.
Yunus wants to see poverty eradicated in this century. Of course, we're in a new century, so there's quite a few years. What do you think?
Well, that's true. He does. And there's an interesting story about that, too. He was conferring with, I believe it was the president of Chile or something, and was saying, you know, you've got a pretty small population. You could be the first country to make poverty exist only in museums, and you could be the person to lay the cornerstone of the museum where people would have to go if they wanted to see what poverty looked like. So yes, his goal is to eradicate poverty from the face of the earth.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Joining us today to explore poverty reduction and peace building are Heidi Top Brooks, a global group leader with Results, the grassroots organization advocating for legislation that will bring millions of people out of poverty, and Coralie Bryant, co-author of the book Reducing Poverty, Building Peace. The discussion about microcredit programs and promotion of what Muhammad Yunus calls social businesses often leads to a discussion over the emphasis on capitalism and the free enterprise system. Let's hear Mr. Yunus talking about this during his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech.
Capitalism centers around free market. It is claimed that the freer the market, the better is the result of capitalism in solving the questions of what, how, and for whom. It is also claimed that the individual search for personal gains brings collective optimal result. I am in favor of strengthening the freedom of the market. At the same time, I am very unhappy about the conceptual restrictions imposed on the players in the market. This originates from the assumption that entrepreneurs are one-dimensional human beings who are dedicated to one mission in their business life: to maximize profit. This interpretation of capitalism insulates the entrepreneurs from all political, emotional, social, spiritual, environmental dimensions of their lives. This was done perhaps as a reasonable simplification, but it stripped away the very essence of human life. Human beings are a wonderful creation, embodied with limitless human qualities and capabilities. Our theoretical constructs should make room for the blossoming of those qualities, not assume them away. Many of the world's problems exist today because of this restriction on the players of the free market. The world has not resolved the problem of crushing poverty, that half of its population suffers. Healthcare remains out of the reach of the majority of the world population. We have remained so impressed by the success of the free market that we never dared to express any doubt about this basic assumption. To make it worse, we worked extra hard to transform ourselves as closely as possible into the one-dimensional human beings as conceptualized in the theory, to allow smooth functioning of the free market mechanism. By defining entrepreneur in a broader way, we can change the character of capitalism radically and solve many of the unresolved social and economic problems within the scope of the free market. Let us suppose an entrepreneur, instead of having a single source of motivation, such as maximizing profit, now has two sources of motivation, which are mutually exclusive, but equally compelling. One, maximization of profit. Another, doing good to people and to the world. Each type of motivation will lead to a separate kind of business. Let us call the first type of business as a profit-maximizing business, and the second type of business as social business. Social business will be a new kind of business introduced in the marketplace with the objective of making difference to the world. Investors in social business could get back their investment money, but will not take any dividend from the company. Profit would be plowed back into the company to expand its outreach and improve the quality of the product or the service. A social business will be a non-loss, non-dividend company. Once social business is recognized in law, many existing companies will come forward to create social businesses in addition to their foundation activities. Many activists from the non-profit sector will also find this as an attractive option. Unlike the non-profit sector, where one needs to collect donations to keep activities going, a social business will be self-sustaining and create surplus for expansion, since it is a non-loss enterprise. Social business will go into a new type of capital market of its own to raise capital. Young people all around the world, particularly in rich countries, will find the concept of social business very appealing, since it will give them a challenge to make a difference by using their creative talents. Many young people today feel frustrated because they cannot see any worthy challenge which excites them within the present capitalist system. Socialism gave them a dream to fight for. Young people dream about creating a perfect world of their own. Almost all social and economic problems of the world will be addressed through the social businesses. The challenge is to innovate business models and apply them to produce desired results cost-effectively and efficiently, such as healthcare for the poor could be a social business, financial services for the poor, information technology for the poor, education and training for the poor, marketing for the poor, renewable energy. These are all exciting ideas for social businesses.
And having read this, reading his acceptance speech, that was probably what the most impressive part of it for me, realizing his brilliance in terms of how he looks at the whole concept of being an entrepreneur. Heidi, do you want to talk a little bit about
sure.
About this?
Muhammad has come up with all kinds of social businesses that that serve good purposes and yet can be profitable. And one terrific example is this yogurt company, and in cooperation, I think, with Danone, where they are producing a high quality, very nutritious, fortified yogurt to improve the health of children who are perhaps malnourished to begin with. But they expect that this company will turn a profit, but will also do very much good. And his whole concept behind all these things is to be socially responsible, to really fill a social need and yet be a viable business. Another good example of that that is probably pretty well known out there are the Grameen phones. And they have phone ladies in 75,000 villages, I believe, where a woman will take out a microcredit loan to buy a cell phone. And she will then sell time on her cell phone in order to repay her loan and to make her living. And this benefits the community in a number of ways. You can imagine that being able to find out what where the best market is to sell your produce would enhance your profitability if you were a farmer. And the same thing kind of holds true in all sorts of other businesses. So these women are making a livelihood, and the phone company, Grameen Phone, is able to make a profit, and the people in the communities are able to do very well by having this avenue for communication. And in conjunction with that is you can imagine that there is no power in these villages. So how do they charge cell phones? Well, Grameen invented or created a solar power company so that these women can recharge their telephones using solar power. So that's another business that does actually good in the environment and provides a valuable commodity to people. And it's owned, again, by poor people. Another terrific example that I absolutely love is that back when Grameen was getting started, the people, the borrowers, often came forward with a problem, which was that their children couldn't see at night. And they investigated and determined that it was due to a vitamin A deficiency. So they studied the matter and thought, okay, well, we could get vitamin A capsules that we can distribute, and the United Nations will give them to us, but or the World Health Organization will give them to us. But today they say, yes, we'll give them to you, and tomorrow maybe not. And then if we tell people that they just need a capsule to solve other problems, they will be coming to us for a capsule for everything. So instead they decided to have people, as a practice that is required of borrowers, to plant vegetables. So this became widespread. And when they did that, there were not enough seeds. And so what did they do? They created a company, a seed company. It's now the biggest seed company in Bangladesh, to sell and distribute seeds to people. So the company is a socially responsible company, and it does a great deal of good. Mm-hmm. And there are a variety of other examples along those lines.
Well, he's essentially redefining what an entrepreneur is, and that it is it's not just the motivation of maximizing profit. You can do that, but also by doing good to people and the world. Coralie, in your work, in your research, does there exist resistance to this kind of work, to a poverty reduction?
Actually, not so much. Now, in some areas, and Grameen ran into this too. Grameen Bank works, as I said, in this country. But Grameen Bank also encountered the fact that it was a little harder to build the trust in some neighborhoods. In some neighborhoods in, for example, parts of Harlem, parts of the South Bronx, New York City, the degrees of cynicism and alienation and anger over racism and social exclusion meant that there was a lot of initial distrust. And participatory work, development work, requires a lot of mutual sharing, mutual talking, connecting with one another within a group. And that was a little harder to do in some places.
Is there anything that makes politicians hesitant to get behind this?
Well, I think we're turning the tide, frankly. I think that we have lots more people. The last time talking to people on Capitol Hill, I was amazed at the number of congressmen from both sides of the aisle that were much more seized of the poverty problem.
True also, Coralie. But I did want to bring up one other thing that I think bears on this and maybe is in response to the question of resistance to working on poverty issues. And that has to do with the present administration's reorganization of USAID. So much of our development money, well, all of it goes through USAID. And this administration has chosen to do a major rework of the entity and change its 19 different departments into just a few. And our concern is that what's going to happen is that rather than focusing on long-term development goals and this kind of work, which USAID was actually set up to do, and it was separated from the State Department for exactly that reason, that now we are going to be competing for funds with the short-term political goals, which have more to do with who the administration particularly likes now in terms of foreign governments and who they dislike. And so whether development occurs might depend on whether that particular person lives in a country that's in or out of favor. So we're very concerned about that.
Well, and you're rightly concerned about that. Though I would add that, in fact, as it happens, because of the growth of civil society, we have an awful lot more private money going through both foundations and NGOs, and sometimes there's an immediacy of the ways in which they can make that be quite effective.
And I'm wondering, as we approach the end here of our discussion, how would you connect the dots for people who question why they should put any thought, energy, or dollars into reducing poverty, either in some far-off land, quote-unquote, or here in our own country? In other words, it's that perennial question, how does that really impact me?
You know, there's since this is a program about peace, I would just like to say that the connection between poverty and peace is very important in that. If you care about peace, you should care about poverty. Coralie has demonstrated pretty conclusively the strong connection between poverty and peace. And results knows of a variety of other indicators that also shore up that position. But I think also there's this internal peace, and I think, Coralie, you probably can speak to this too, that as a human being, you can't really be at peace with yourself knowing that there's poverty out there that we could be changing, we could be alleviating, we could be helping people to alleviate themselves. And so in order to have peace in our own hearts, I think it's important to care about poverty.
Let me ask both of you to offer a suggestion about how listeners can become active in poverty-reducing efforts. Certainly, Heidi, your organization, Results, is a grassroots organization that encourages participation.
Mm-hmm.
So what can
mm-hmm.
you offer to our listeners about Results?
Oh, Results is terrific. And you can take action very, very easily by going to the Results website. It's just results.org. And there are ways that you can take action on the site. But I really encourage people to go beyond that and find a local group, become active, and go and mm-hmm. talk to your members of Congress. Mm-hmm. You know, really speak to them, because we have found that even the ones that you just think you won't reach, they're human too. And if you remind them of why they originally went into office, what they wanted to accomplish, together we can get a lot done. So I do encourage them to become active in that way.
That's Heidi Topp Brooks, who is the Albuquerque head of Results, a nonprofit organization working on ending global hunger and poverty. We also heard Dr. Coralie Bryant, recently with Columbia University in New York and co-author of the book Reducing Poverty and Building Peace. Carol Boss was our host. You can hear this program again or read a partial transcript and find links to other resources by visiting our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear all the programs in our series, order CDs of them, sign up for a monthly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. That's also where you can do your part to make a tax-deductible contribution to ensure that we can continue to bring talk of peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution to the radio and to the web. All at peacetalksradio.com. In addition to support from listeners like you, we also have support from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, the Peace Tales CD Project, and KUNM. Music by Allie Adelman. We had production assistance from Jesse Baker. Peace Talks Radio is a production of the nonprofit media organization Good Radio Shows Incorporated. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening.